Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Chapter 1 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Sarah Jennings. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 1. The Thoughts of Youth. The sunshine of a day in early spring, honey-pale and honey-sweet, was showering over the red brick buildings of Queensley College and the grounds about them, throwing through the bare budding maples and elms delicate evasive etchings of gold and brown on the paths, and coaxing into life the daffodils that were peering greenly and perkily up under the windows of the co-ed's dressing-room. A young April wind, as fresh and sweet as if it had been blowing over the fields of memory instead of through dingy streets, was purring in the treetops and whipping the loose tendrils of the ivy network which covered the front of the main building. It was a wind that sang of many things, but what it sang to each listener was only what was in that listener's heart. To the college students who had just been capped and diplomed by Old Charlie, the grave president of Queensley, in the presence of an admiring throng of parents and sisters, sweethearts and friends, it sang perchance of glad hope and shining success and high achievement. It sang of the dreams of youth that may never be quite fulfilled, but are well worth the dreaming for all that. God help the man who has never known such dreams, who, as he leaves his alma mater, is not already rich in aerial castles, the proprietor of many a spacious estate in Spain. He has missed his birthright. The crowd streamed out of the entrance hall and scattered over the campus, fraying off into the many streets beyond. Eric Marshall and David Baker walked away together. The former had graduated in arts that day at the head of his class. The latter had come to see the graduation, nearly bursting with pride in Eric's success. Between these two was an old and tried and enduring friendship, although David was 10 years older than Eric, as the mere tale of years goes, and 100 years older in knowledge of the struggles and difficulties of life which age a man far more quickly and effectually than the passing of time. Physically, the two men bore no resemblance to one another, although they were second cousins. Eric Marshall, tall, broad-shouldered, sinewy, walking with a free, easy stride, which was somehow suggestive of reserve, strength, and power, was one of those men regarding whom less favored mortals are tempted to seriously wonder why all the gifts of fortune should be showered on one individual. He was not only clever and good to look upon, but he possessed that indefinable charm of personality, which is quite independent of physical beauty or mental ability. He had steady, grayish-blue eyes, dark chestnut hair with a glint of gold in its waves when the sunlight struck it, and a chin that gave the world assurance of a chin. He was a rich man's son, with a clean young manhood behind him and splendid prospects before him. He was considered a practical sort of fellow, utterly guiltless of romantic dreams and visions of any sort. "I am afraid Eric Marshall will never do one quixotic thing," said a Queensley professor, who had a habit of uttering rather mysterious epigrams. "But if he does, it will supply the one thing lacking in him." David Baker was a short, stocky fellow with an ugly, irregular, charming face. His eyes were brown and keen and secretive. His mouth had a comical twist which became sarcastic or teasing or winning, as he willed. His voice was generally as soft and musical as a woman's, but some few who had seen David Baker righteously angry and heard the tones which then issued from his lips were in no hurry to have the experience repeated. He was a doctor, a specialist in troubles of the throat and voice, and he was beginning to have a national reputation. He was on the staff of the Queensley Medical College, and it was whispered that before long he would be called to fill an important vacancy at McGill. He had won his way to success through difficulties and drawbacks which would have daunted most men. In the year Eric was born, David Baker was an errand boy in the big department store of Marshall and Company. 13 years later he graduated with high honors from Queensley Medical College. Mr. Marshall had given him all the help which David's sturdy pride could be induced to accept, and now he insisted on sending the young man abroad for a postgraduate course in London and Germany. David Baker had eventually repaid every cent Mr. Marshall had expended on him, but he never ceased to cherish a passionate gratitude to the kind and generous man, and he loved that man's son with a love surpassing that of brothers. He had followed Eric's college course with keen, watchful interest. It was his wish that Eric should take up the study of law or medicine now that he was through arts, and he was greatly disappointed that Eric should have finally made up his mind to go into business with his father. "It's a clean waste of your talents," he grumbled as they walked home from the college. "You'd win fame and distinction in law. That glib tongue of yours was meant for a lawyer, and it is sheer flying in the face of Providence to devote it to commercial uses, a flat crossing of the purposes of destiny. Where is your ambition, man?" "It is in the right place," answered Eric with his ready laugh. "It is not your kind, perhaps, but there is room and need for all kinds in this lusty young country of ours. Yes, I am going into the business. In the first place, it has been father's cherished desire ever since I was born, and it would hurt him pretty badly if I backed out now. He wished me to take an arts course, because he believed that every man should have as liberal an education as he can afford to get. But now that I have had it, he wants me in the firm. He wouldn't oppose you if you thought you really wanted to go in for something else." "Not he. But I don't really want to, that's the point, David, man. You hate a business life so much that you can't get it into your blessed noodle that another man might like it. There are many lawyers in the world, too many, perhaps. But there are never too many good, honest men of business ready to do clean, big things for the betterment of humanity and the upbuilding of their country, to plan great enterprises and carry them through with brain and courage, to manage and control, to aim high and strike one's aim. There, I am waxing eloquent, so I'd better stop. But ambition, man, why, I am full of it. It's bubbling up in every pore of me. I mean to make the department store of Marshall and Company famous from ocean to ocean. Father started in life as a poor boy from a Nova Scotian farm. He has built up a business that has a provincial reputation. I mean to carry it on. In 5 years it shall have a maritime reputation, in 10 a Canadian. I want to make the firm of Marshall and Company stand for something big in the commercial interests of Canada. Isn't that as honorable an ambition as trying to make black seem white in a court of law, or discovering some new disease with a harrowing name to torment poor creatures who might otherwise die peacefully in blissful ignorance of what ailed them? When you begin to make poor jokes, it is time to stop arguing with you," said David, with a shrug of his fat shoulders. "Go your own gait and dree your own weird. I'd as soon expect success in trying to storm the citadel single-handed as in trying to turn you from any course about which you had once made up your mind. Whew, this street takes it out of a fellow. What could have possessed our ancestors to run a town up the side of a hill? I'm not so slim and active as I was on my graduation day 10 years ago. By the way, what a lot of co-eds were in your class. 20, if I counted right. When I graduated, there were only 2 ladies in our class, and they were the pioneers of their sex at Queensley. They were well past their first youth, very grim and angular and serious. They could never have been on speaking terms with a mirror in their best days. But mark you, they were excellent females. Oh, very excellent. Times have changed with a vengeance, judging from the lineup of co-eds today. There was one girl there who can't be a day over 18, and she looked as if she were made out of gold and rose leaves and dewdrops." "The oracle speaks in poetry," laughed Eric. "That was Florence Percival, who led the class in mathematics as I'm a living man. By many she is considered the beauty of her class. I can't say that such is my opinion. I don't greatly care for that blonde, babyish style of loveliness. I prefer Agnes Campion. Did you notice her? The tall, dark girl with the ropes of hair and a sort of crimson, velvety bloom on her face, who took honors in philosophy." "I did notice her," said David emphatically, darting a keen side glance at his friend. "I noticed her most particularly and critically. For someone whispered her name behind me and coupled it with the exceedingly interesting information that Miss Campion was supposed to be the future Mrs. Eric Marshall, whereupon I stared at her with all my eyes." "There is no truth in that report," said Eric in a tone of annoyance. Agnes and I are the best of friends, and nothing more. I like and admire her more than any woman I know. But if the future Mrs. Eric Marshall exists in the flesh, I haven't met her yet. I haven't even started out to look for her, and don't intend to for some years to come. I have something else to think of," he concluded in a tone of contempt, for which anyone might have known he would be punished some time if Cupid were not deaf as well as blind. "You'll meet the lady of your future some day," said David dryly, "and in spite of your scorn I venture to predict that if fate doesn't bring her before long, you'll very soon start out to look for her. A word of advice, O son of your mother, when you go courting, take your common sense with you." "Do you think I shall be likely to leave it behind?" asked Eric amusedly. "Well, I mistrust you," said David, sagely wagging his head. "The lowland Scotch part of you is all right, but there's a Celtic streak in you from that little Highland grandmother of yours, and when a man has that, there's never any knowing where it will break out, or what dance it will lead him, especially when it comes to this love-making business. You are just as likely as not to lose your head over some little fool or shrew for the sake of her outward favour, and make yourself miserable for life. When you pick a wife, please remember that I shall reserve the right to pass a candid opinion on her." "Pass all the opinions you like, but it is my opinion, and mine only, which will matter in the long run," retorted Eric. "Confound you, yes, you stubborn offshoot of a stubborn breed," growled David, looking at him affectionately. "I know that, and that is why I'll never feel at ease about you until I see you married to the right sort of girl. 9 out of 10 girls in this country of ours are fit for king's palaces. But the 10th always has to be reckoned with. You are as bad as clever Alice in the fairy tale, who worried over the future of her unborn children," protested Eric. "Clever Alice has been very unjustly laughed at," said David gravely. "We doctors know that. Perhaps she overdid the worrying business a little, but she was perfectly right in principle. If people worried a little more about their unborn children, at least to the extent of providing a proper heritage, physically, mentally, and morally, for them, and then stopped worrying about them after they are born, this world would be a very much pleasanter place to live in, and the human race would make more progress in a generation than it has done in recorded history. Oh, if you are going to mount your dearly beloved hobby of heredity, I am not going to argue with you, David, man. But as for the matter of urging me to hasten and marry me a wife, why don't you—" It was on Eric's lips to say, "Why don't you get married to a girl of the right sort yourself, and set me a good example?" But he checked himself. He knew that there was an old sorrow in David Baker's life which was not to be unduly jarred by the jests even of privileged friendship. He changed his question to, "Why don't you leave this on the knees of the gods where it properly belongs? I thought you were a firm believer in predestination, David." "Well, so I am, to a certain extent," said David cautiously. "I believe, as an excellent old aunt of mine used to say, that what is to be will be, and what isn't to be sometimes happens. And it is precisely such unchancy happenings that make the scheme of things go wrong. I dare say you think me an old fogey, Eric, but I know something more of the world than you do, and I believe with Tennyson's Arthur that there's no more subtle master under heaven than is the maiden passion for a maid. I want to see you safely anchored to the love of some good woman as soon as may be, that's all. I'm rather sorry Miss Campion isn't your lady of the future. I liked her looks, that I did. She is good and strong and true, and has the eyes of a woman who could love in a way that would be worth while. Moreover, she's well-born, well-bred, and well-educated, three very indispensable things when it comes to choosing a woman to fill your mother's place, friend of mine." "I agree with you," said Eric carelessly. "I could not marry any woman who did not fulfill those conditions. But as I have said, I am not in love with Agnes Campion, and it wouldn't be of any use if I were. She is as good as engaged to Larry West. You remember West. That thin, leggy fellow you chummed with so much your first 2 years at Queensley. Yes, what has become of him?" "He had to drop out after his second year for financial reasons. He is working his own way through college, you know. For the past 2 years he has been teaching school in some out-of-the-way place over in Prince Edward Island. He isn't any too well, poor fellow. Never was very strong, and has studied remorselessly. I haven't heard from him since February. He said then that he was afraid he wasn't going to be able to stick it out till the end of the school year. I hope Larry won't break down. He is a fine fellow and worthy even of Agnes Campion. Well, here we are. Coming in, David?" "Not this afternoon. Haven't got time. I must mosey up to the North End to see a man who has got a lovely throat. Nobody can find out what is the matter. He has puzzled all the doctors. He has puzzled me, but I'll find out what is wrong with him, if he'll only live long enough. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Sarah Jennings. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 2. A Letter of Destiny. Eric, finding that his father had not yet returned from the college, went into the library and sat down to read a letter he had picked up from the hall table. It was from Larry West, and after the first few lines, Eric's face lost the absent look it had worn, and assumed an expression of interest. "I'm writing to ask a favor of you, Marshall," wrote West. "The fact is, I've fallen into the hands of the Philistines, that is to say, the doctors. I've not been feeling very fit all winter, but I've held on, hoping to finish out the year. Last week my landlady, who is a saint in spectacles and calico, looked at me one morning at the breakfast table and said, very gently, 'You must go to town tomorrow, master, and see a doctor about yourself.' I went, and did not stand upon the order of my going. Mrs. Williamson is she who must be obeyed. She has an inconvenient habit of making you realize that she is exactly right, and that you would be all kinds of a fool if you didn't take her advice. You feel that what she thinks today, you will think tomorrow. In Charlottetown I consulted a doctor. He punched and pounded me, and poked things at me, and listened at the other end of them. And finally he said I must stop work immediately in Toonkt, and hie me straightway to a climate not affected with the northeast winds of Prince Edward Island in the spring. I am not to be allowed to do any work until the fall. Such was his dictum, and Mrs. Williamson enforces it. I shall teach this week out, and then the spring vacation of 3 weeks begins. I want you to come over and take my place as pedagogue in the Lindsay School for the last week of May and the month of June. The school year ends then, and there will be plenty of teachers looking for the place, but just now I cannot get a suitable substitute. I have a couple of pupils who are preparing to try the Queen's Academy entrance examinations, and I don't like to leave them in the lurch, or hand them over to the tender mercies of some third-class teacher who knows little Latin and less Greek. Come over and take the school till the end of the term, you petted son of luxury. It will do you a world of good to learn how rich a man feels when he is earning $25 a month by his own unaided efforts. Seriously, Marshall, I hope you can come, for I don't know any other fellow I can ask. The work isn't hard, though you'll likely find it monotonous. Of course, this little North Shore farming settlement isn't a very lively place. The rising and setting of the sun are the most exciting events of the average day, but the people are very kind and hospitable, and Prince Edward Island in the month of June is such a thing as you don't often see except in happy dreams. There are some trout in the pond, and you'll always find an old salt at the harbour ready and willing to take you out cod-fishing or lobstering. I'll bequeath you my boarding-house. You'll find it comfortable, and not further from the school than a good constitutional. Mrs. Williamson is the dearest soul alive, and she is one of those old-fashioned cooks who feed you on feasts of fat things, and whose price is above rubies. Her husband Robert, or Bob, as he is commonly called, despite his 60 years, is quite a character in his way. He is an amusing old gossip, with a turn for racy comment and a finger in everybody's pie. He knows everything about everybody in Lindsay for 3 generations back. They have no living children, but old Bob has a black cat which is his especial pride and darling. The name of this animal is Timothy, and as such he must always be called and referred to. Never, as you value Robert's good opinion, let him hear you speak of his pet as the cat, or even as Tim. You will never be forgiven, and he will not consider you a fit person to have charge of the school. You shall have my room, a little place over the kitchen, with a ceiling that follows the slant of the roof down one side, against which you will bump your head times innumerable until you learn to remember that it is there, and a looking-glass which will make one of your eyes as small as a pea, and the other as big as an orange. But to compensate for these disadvantages, the supply of towels is generous and unexceptionable, and there is a window whence you will daily behold an occidental view over Lindsay Harbour and the gulf beyond, which is an unspeakable miracle of beauty. The sun is setting over it as I write, and I see such a sea of glass mingled with fire as might have figured in the visions of the Patmian seer. A vessel is sailing away into the gold and crimson and pearl of the horizon. The big revolving light on the tip of the headland beyond the harbour has just been lighted, and is winking and flashing like a beacon o'er the foam of perilous seas and fairy lands forlorn. Wire me if you can come, and if you can, report for duty on the 23rd of May. Mr. Marshall Sr. came in, just as Eric was thoughtfully folding up his letter. The former looked more like a benevolent old clergyman or philanthropist than the keen, shrewd, somewhat hard, although just and honest man of business that he really was. He had a round, rosy face, fringed with white whiskers, a fine head of long white hair, and a pursed-up mouth. Only in his blue eyes was a twinkle that would have made any man who designed getting the better of him in a bargain think twice before he made the attempt. It was easily seen that Eric must have inherited his personal beauty and distinction of form from his mother, whose picture hung on the dark wall between the windows. She had died while still young, when Eric was a boy of 10. During her lifetime she had been the object of the passionate devotion of both her husband and son, and the fine, strong, sweet face of the picture was a testimony that she had been worthy of their love and reverence. The same face, cast in a masculine mould, was repeated in Eric. The chestnut hair grew off his forehead in the same way. His eyes were like hers, and in his grave moods they held a similar expression, half-brooding, half-tender, in their depths. Mr. Marshall was very proud of his son's success in college, but he had no intention of letting him see it. He loved this boy of his with the dead mother's eyes better than anything on earth, and all his hopes and ambitions were bound up in him. "Well, that fuss is over, thank goodness," he said testily as he dropped into his favorite chair. "Didn't you find the program interesting?" asked Eric absently. "Most of it was tommy rot," said his father. "The only things I liked were Charlie's Latin prayer and those pretty little girls trotting up to get their diplomas." "Latin is the language for praying in, I do believe. At least when a man has a voice like old Charlie's. There was such a sonorous roll to the words that the mere sound of them made me feel like getting down on my marrow bones. And then those girls were pretty as pinks, now weren't they? Agnes was the finest-looking of the lot, in my opinion. I hope it's true that you're courting her, Eric." "Confound it, father," said Eric, half-irritably, half-laughingly. "Have you and David Baker entered into a conspiracy to hound me into matrimony, whether I will or no?" "I've never said a word to David Baker on such a subject," protested Mr. Marshall. "Well, you are just as bad as he is. He hectored me all the way home from college on the subject. But why are you in such a hurry to have me married, Dad?" "Because I want a homemaker in this house as soon as may be. There's never been one since your mother died. I'm tired of housekeepers. And I want to see your children at my knees before I die, Eric, and I'm an old man now." "Well, your wish is natural, father," said Eric gently, with a glance at his mother's picture. "But I can't rush out and marry somebody offhand, can I? And I fear it wouldn't exactly do to advertise for a wife, even in these days of commercial enterprise." "Isn't there anybody you're fond of?" queried Mr. Marshall, with the patient air of a man who overlooks the frivolous jests of youth. "Nope, I never yet saw the woman who could make my heart beat any faster." "I don't know what you young men are made of nowadays," growled his father. "I was in love half a dozen times before I was your age." "You might have been in love, but you never loved any woman until you met my mother. I know that, father. And it didn't happen till you were pretty well on in life, either." "You're too hard to please. That's what's the matter. That's what's the matter." "Perhaps I am. When a man has had a mother like mine, his standard of womanly sweetness is apt to be pitched pretty high. Let's drop the subject, father. Here, I want you to read this letter. It's from Larry."
"Humph," grunted Mr. Marshall when he had finished with it.
"So, Larry's knocked out at last. Always thought he would be. Always expected it. Sorry, too. He was a decent fellow. Well, are you going?"
"Yes, I think so, if you don't object."
"You'll have a pretty monotonous time of it, judging from his account of Lindsay."
"Probably. But I'm not going over in search of excitement. I'm going to oblige Larry and have a look at the island."
"Well, it's worth looking at some parts of the year," conceded Mr. Marshall. "When I'm on Prince Edward Island in the summer, I always understand an old Scotch islander I met once in Winnipeg. He was always talking of the island. Somebody asked him once, 'What island do you mean?' He simply looked at that ignorant man. Then he said, 'Why, Prince Edward Island, man! What other island is there?' "'Go if you'd like to. You need a rest after the grind of examinations before settling down to business. And mind you don't get into any mischief, young sir.'
"'Not much likelihood of that in a place like Lindsay, I fancy,' laughed Eric.
"'Probably the devil finds as much mischief for idle hands in Lindsay as anywhere else. The worst tragedy I ever heard of happened on a backwoods farm, 15 miles from a railroad and 5 from a store. However, I expect your mother's son to behave himself in the fear of God and man.
In all likelihood, the worst thing that will happen to you over there is that some misguided woman will put you to sleep in a spare room bed. And if that does happen, may the Lord have mercy on your soul. End of chapter 2. Chapter 3 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Sarah Jennings. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 3. The Master of Lindsay School. One evening, a month later, Eric Marshall came out of the old whitewashed schoolhouse at Lindsay and locked the door, which was carved over with initials innumerable, and built of double plank in order that it might withstand all the assaults and batteries to which it might be subjected. Eric's pupils had gone home an hour before, but he had stayed to solve some algebra problems and correct some Latin exercises for his advanced students. The sun was slanting in warm yellow lines through the thick grove of maples to the west of the building, and the dim green air beneath them burst into golden bloom. A couple of sheep were nibbling the lush grass in the far corner of the playground. A cowbell somewhere in the maple woods tinkled faintly and musically on the still crystal air, which, in spite of its blandness, still retained a touch of the wholesome austerity and poignancy of a Canadian spring. The whole world seemed to have fallen for the time being into a pleasant, untroubled dream. The scene was very peaceful and pastoral. Almost too much so, the young man thought, with a shrug of his shoulders, as he stood in the worn steps and gazed about him. How was he going to put in a whole month here, he wondered, with a little smile at his own expense. Father would chuckle if he knew I was sick of it already, he thought, as he walked across the playground to the long red road that ran past the school. Well, 1 week is ended at any rate. I've earned my own living for 5 whole days, and that is something I could never say before in all my 24 years of existence. It is an exhilarating thought. But teaching the Lindsay District School is distinctly not exhilarating. At least not in such a well-behaved school as this, where the pupils are so painfully good that I haven't even the traditional excitement of thrashing obstreperous bad boys. Everything seems to go by clockwork in Lindsay Educational Institution. Larry must certainly have possessed a marked gift for organizing and drilling. I feel as if I were merely a big cog in an orderly machine that ran itself. However, I understand that there are some pupils who haven't shown up yet, and who, according to all reports, have not had the old Adam totally drilled out of them. They may make things more interesting. Also, a few more compositions, such as John Reed's, would furnish some spice to professional life. Eric's laughter wakened the echoes as he swung into the road down the long, sloping hill. He had given his fourth-grade pupils their own choice of subjects in the composition class that morning, and John Reed, a sober, matter-of-fact little urchin, with not the slightest embryonic development of a sense of humor, had, acting upon the whispered suggestion of a roguish deskmate, elected to write upon courting. His opening sentence made Eric's face twitch mutinously whenever he recalled it during the day. Courting is a very pleasant thing, which a great many people go too far with. The distant hills and wooded uplands were tremulous and aerial in delicate springtime gauzes of pearl and purple. The young green-leafed maples crowded thickly to the very edge of the road on either side, but beyond them were emerald fields basking in sunshine, over which cloud shadows rolled, broadened, and vanished. Far below the fields a calm ocean slept bluely and sighed in its sleep, with the murmur that rings forever in the ear of those whose good fortune it is to have been born within the sound of it. Now and then Eric met some callow, check-shirted, bare-legged lad on horseback, or a shrewd-faced farmer in a cart, who nodded and called out cheerily, "Howdy, master!" A young girl with a rosy oval face, dimpled cheeks, and pretty dark eyes filled with shy coquetry, passed him, looking as if she would not be at all averse to a better acquaintance with the new teacher. Halfway down the hill, Eric met a shambling old gray horse drawing an express wagon which had seen better days. The driver was a woman. She appeared to be one of those drab-tinted individuals who can never have felt a rosy emotion in all their lives. She stopped her horse, and beckoned Eric over to her with the knobby handle of a faded and bony umbrella. "Reckon you're the new master, ain't you?" she asked. Eric admitted that he was. "Well, I'm glad to see you," she said, offering him a hand in a much-darned cotton glove that had once been black. I was right sorry to see Mr. West go, for he was a right good teacher, and as harmless, inoffensive a creature as ever lived. But I always told him, every time I laid eyes on him, that he was in consumption, if ever a man was. You look real healthy, though you can't always tell by looks, either. I had a brother complected like you, but he was killed in a railroad accident out west when he was real young. I've got a boy I'll be sending to school to you next week. He oughter gone this week, but I had to keep him home to help me put the potatoes in, for his father won't work and doesn't work and can't be made to work. Sandy, his full name is Edward Alexander, called after both his grandfathers, hates the idea of going to school worse than poison, always did. Go he shall, for I'm determined he's got to have more learning hammered into his head yet. I reckon you'll have trouble with him, master, for he's as stupid as an owl and as stubborn as Solomon's mule. But mind this, master, I'll back you up. You just lick Sandy good and plenty when he needs it. Send me a scrape of the pen home with him, and I'll give him another dose. There's people that always sides in with their young'uns when there's any rumpus kicked up in the school, but I don't hold to that, never did. You can depend on Rebecca Reed every time, master. Thank you, I'm sure I can, said Eric in his most winning tones. He kept his face straight until it was safe to relax, and Mrs. Reed drove on with a soft feeling in her leathery old heart, which had been so toughened by long endurance of poverty and toil and a husband who wouldn't work and couldn't be made to work, that it was no longer a very susceptible organ where members of the opposite sex were concerned. Mrs. Reed reflected that this young man had a way with him. Eric already knew most of the Lindsay folks by sight, but at the foot of the hill he met two people, a man and a boy, whom he did not know. They were sitting in a shabby old-fashioned wagon, and were watering their horse at the brook, which gurgled limpidly under the little plank bridge in the hollow. Eric surveyed them with some curiosity. They did not look in the least like the ordinary run of Lindsay people. The boy in particular had a distinctly foreign appearance, in spite of the gingham shirt and homespun trousers, which seemed to be the regulation workaday outfit for the Lindsay farmer lads. He had a lithe, supple body, with sloping shoulders, and a lean, satiny brown throat above his open shirt collar. His head was covered with thick, silky black curls, and the hand that hung down by the side of the wagon was unusually long and slender. His face was richly, though somewhat heavily, featured, olive-tinted, save for the cheeks, which had a dusky crimson bloom. His mouth was as red and beguiling as a girl's, and his eyes were large, bold, and black. All in all, he was a strikingly handsome fellow, but the expression of his face was sullen, and he somehow gave Eric the impression of a sinuous feline creature basking in lazy grace, but ever ready for an unexpected spring. The other occupant of the wagon was a man between 65 and 70, with iron-gray hair, a long, full gray beard, a harsh-featured face, and deep-set hazel eyes under bushy, bristling brows. He was evidently tall, with a spare, ungainly figure and stooping shoulders. His mouth was close-lipped and relentless, and did not look as if it had ever smiled. Indeed, the idea of smiling could not be connected with this man. It was utterly incongruous. Yet there was nothing repellent about his face, and there was something in it that compelled Eric's attention. He rather prided himself on being a student of physiognomy, and he felt quite sure that this man was no ordinary Lindsay farmer of the genial, garrulous type with which he was familiar. Long after the old wagon with its oddly assorted pair had gone lumbering up the hill, Eric found himself thinking of the stern, heavy-browed man, and the black-eyed, red-lipped boy. End of chapter 3.
Chapter 4 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Missy, Guangzhou, China. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 4. A Tea Table Conversation. The Williamson place, where Eric boarded, was on the crest of the succeeding hill. He liked it as well as Larry West had prophesied that he would. The Williamsons, as well as the rest of the Lindsay people, took it for granted that he was a poor college student working his way through, as Larry West had been doing. Eric did not disturb this belief, although he said nothing to contribute to it. The Williamsons were at tea in the kitchen when Eric went in. Mrs. Williamson was the saint in spectacles and calico, which Larry West had termed her. Eric liked her greatly. She was a slight, gray-haired woman, with a thin, sweet, high-bred face, deeply lined with the records of outlived pain. She talked little as a rule, but, in the pungent country phrase, she never spoke but she said something. The one thing that constantly puzzled Eric was how such a woman ever came to marry Robert Williamson. She smiled in a motherly fashion at Eric as he hung his hat on the whitewashed wall and took his place at the table. Outside of the window behind him was a birch grove, which in the westering sun was a tremulous splendor, with a sea of undergrowth wavered into golden billows by every passing wind. Old Robert Williamson sat opposite him, on a bench. He was a small, lean old man, half lost in loose clothes that seemed far too large for him. When he spoke, his voice was as thin and squeaky as he appeared to be himself. The other end of the bench was occupied by Timothy, sleek and complacent, with a snowy breast and white paws. After old Robert had taken a mouthful of anything, he gave a piece to Timothy, who ate it daintily and purred resonant gratitude. "You see, we're busy waiting for you, master," said old Robert. "You're late this evening. Keep any of the youngsters in. That's a foolish way of punishing them, as hard on yourself as on them. One teacher we had 4 years ago used to lock them in and go home. Then he'd go back in an hour and let them out. If they were there, they weren't always. Tom Ferguson kicked the panels out of the old door once and got out that way. We put a new door of double plank in that they couldn't kick out." "I stayed in the schoolroom to do some work," said Eric briefly. "Well, you've missed Alexander Tracy. He was here to find out if you could play checkers, and when I told him you could, he left word for you to go up and have a game some evening soon. Don't beat him too often, even if you can. You'll need to stand in with him, I tell you, master, for he's got a son that may brew trouble for you when he starts in to go to school. Seth Tracy's a young imp, and he'd far sooner be in mischief than eat. He tries to run on every new teacher, and he's run two clean out of the school. But he met his match in Mr. West. William Tracy's boys, now, you won't have a scrap of bother with them. They're always good, because their mother tells them every Sunday that they'll go straight to hell if they don't behave in school. It's effective. Take some preserve, master. You know we don't help things here the way Mrs. Adam Scott does when she has boarders. I suppose you don't want any of this, nor you, nor you. Mother Alex says old George Wright is having the time of his life. His wife has gone to Charlottetown to visit her sister, and he is his own boss for the first time since he was married 40 years ago. He's on a regular orgy, Alex says. He smokes in the parlor and sits up till 11 o'clock reading dime novels. Perhaps I met Mr. Tracy, said Eric. Is he a tall man, with gray hair and a dark, stern face? No, he's a round, jolly fellow, is Alec, and he stopped growing pretty much before he'd ever begun. I reckon the man you mean is Thomas Gordon. I seen him driving down the road, too. He won't be troubling you with invitations up. Small fear of it. The Gordons ain't sociable, to say the least of it. No, sir. Mother, pass the biscuits to the master. Who was the young fellow he had with him? Asked Eric, curiously. Neil Gordon. That is a Scotchy name for such a face and eyes. I should rather have expected Giuseppe or Angelo. The boy looks like an Italian. Well, now you know, master, I reckon it's likely he does, seeing that that's exactly what he is. You've hit the nail square on the head. Italian, yes, sir. Rather too much so, I'm thinking, for decent folks' taste. How has it happened that an Italian boy with a Scotch name is living in a place like Lindsay? Well, master, it was this way. About 22 years ago, was it 22, mother, or 24? Yes, it was 22. 'Twas the same year our Jim was born, and he'd have been 22 if he'd lived. Poor little fellow. Well, master, 22 years ago, a couple of Italian pack peddlers came along and called at the Gordon place. The country was swarming with them then. I used to set the dog on one every day, on an average. Well, these peddlers were man and wife, and the woman took sick up there at the Gordon place, and Janet Gordon took her in and nursed her. A baby was born the next day, and the woman died. Then the first thing anybody knew, the father skipped clean out, pack and all, and was never seen or heard tell of afterwards. The Gordons were left with the fine youngster to their hands. Folks advised them to send him to the orphan asylum, and 'twould have been the wisest plan, but the Gordons were never fond of taking advice. Old James Gordon was living then, Thomas and Janet's father, and he said he would never turn a child out of his door. He was a masterful old man and liked to be boss. Folks used to say he had a grudge against the sun 'cause it rose and set without his say-so. Anyhow, they kept the baby. They called him Neil and had him baptized same as any Christian child. He's always lived there. They did well enough by him. He was sent to school and taken to church and treated like one of themselves. Some folks think they made too much of him. It doesn't always do with that kind, for what's bread and bone is mighty apt to come out in flesh, if 'tain't kept down pretty well. Neil's smart and a great worker, they tell me. But folks hereabouts don't like him. They say he ain't to be trusted further than you can see him, if as far. It's certain he's awful hot-tempered, and one time when he was going to school he near about killed a boy he took a spite to, choked him till he was black in the face, and Neil had to be dragged off. "Well, now, father, you know they teased him terrible," protested Mrs. Williamson. "The poor boy had a real hard time when he went to school, master. The other children were always casting things up to him and calling him names." "Oh, I dare say they tormented him a lot," admitted her husband. "He's a great hand at the fiddle and likes company. He goes to the harbor a good deal. But they say he takes sulky spells when he hasn't a word to throw to a dog. 'Twouldn't be any wonder, living with the Gordons. They're all as queer as Dick's hatband." "Father, you shouldn't talk so about your neighbors," said his wife rebukingly. "Well, now, mother, you know they are, if you'd only speak up honest. But you're like old Aunt Nancy Scott. You never say anything uncharitable except in the way of business. You know the Gordons ain't like other people, and never were and never will be. They're about the only queer folks we have in Lindsay, master, except old Peter Cook, who keeps 25 cats. Lord, master, think of it. What chance would a poor mouse have? None of the rest of us are queer, leastwise we hain't found it out if we are. But then we're mighty uninteresting, I'm bound to admit that." "Where do the Gordons live?" asked Eric, who had grown used to holding fast to a given point of inquiry through all the bewildering mazes of old Robert's conversation. "Away up yonder, half a mile in from Radnor Road, with a thick spruce wood atween them and all the rest of the world. They never go away anywheres, except to church. They never miss that, and nobody goes there. There's just old Thomas and his sister Janet and a niece of theirs, and this here Neil we've been talking about. They're a queer, dour, cranky lot, and I will say it, mother. There, give your old man a cup of tea, and never mind the way his tongue runs on. Speaking of tea, do you know Mrs. Adam Palmer and Mrs. Jim Martin took tea together at Foster Reed's last Wednesday afternoon?" "No. Why, I thought they were on bad terms," said Mrs. Williamson, betraying a little feminine curiosity. "So they are, so they are. But they both happened to visit Mrs. Foster the same afternoon, and neither would leave, because that would be knuckling down to the other. So they stuck it out, on opposite sides of the parlor. Mrs. Foster says she never spent such an uncomfortable afternoon in all her life before. She would talk a spell to one, and then t'other, and they kept talking to Mrs. Foster and at each other. Mrs. Foster says she really thought she'd have to keep them all night, for neither would start to go home afore the other. Finally Jim Martin came in to look for his wife, 'cause he thought she must have got stuck in the marsh, and that solved the problem. Master, you ain't eaten anything. Don't mind my stopping. I was at it half an hour afore you came, and anyway I'm in a hurry. My hired boy went home today. He heard the rooster crow at 12 last night, and he's gone home to see which of his family is dead. He knows one of 'em is. He heard a rooster crow in the middle of the night once to four, and the next day he got word his second cousin down at Souris was dead. Mother, if the master don't want any more tea, ain't there some cream for Timothy?" End of chapter 4.
Chapter 5 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Katie Gibney, Arkansas, February 2008. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 5, A Phantom of Delight. Shortly before sunset that evening, Eric went for a walk. When he did not go to the shore, he liked to indulge in long tramps through the Lindsay fields and woods in the mellowness of the sweet of the year. Most of the Lindsay houses were built along the main road, which ran parallel to the shore, or about the stores at the corner. The farms ran back from them into solitudes of woods and pasture lands. Eric struck southwest from the Williamson homestead in a direction he had not hitherto explored, and walked briskly along, enjoying the witchery of the season all about him in earth and air and sky. He felt it and loved it and yielded to it, as anyone of clean life and sane pulses must do. The spruce wood in which he presently found himself was smitten through with arrows of ruby light from the setting sun. He went through it, walking up a long purple aisle where the wood floor was brown and elastic under his feet, and came out beyond it on a scene which surprised him. No house was in sight, but he found himself looking into an orchard, an old orchard, evidently long neglected and forsaken. But an orchard dies hard, and this one, which must have been a very delightful spot once, was delightful still, none the less so for the air of gentle melancholy which seemed to pervade it. The melancholy which invests all places that have once been the scenes of joy and pleasure and young life, and are so no longer, places where hearts have throbbed, and pulses thrilled, and eyes brightened, and merry voices echoed. The ghosts of these things seem to linger in their old haunts through many empty years. The orchard was large and long, enclosed in a tumble-down old fence of longers, bleached to a silvery gray in the suns of many lost summers. At regular intervals along the fence were tall, gnarled fir trees, and an evening wind, sweeter than that which blew over the beds of spice from Lebanon, was singing in their tops, an earth-old song with power to carry the soul back to the dawn of time. Eastward, a thick fir wood grew, beginning with tiny treelets just feathering from the grass, and grading up therefrom to the tall veterans of the mid-grove, unbrokenly and evenly, giving the effect of a solid, sloping green wall, so beautifully compact that it looked as if it had been clipped into its velvet surface by art. Most of the orchard was grown over lushly with grass, but at the end where Eric stood there was a square, treeless place which had evidently once served as a homestead garden. Old paths were still visible, bordered by stones and large pebbles. There were two clumps of lilac trees, one blossoming in royal purple, the other in white. Between them was a bed aglow with the starry spikes of June lilies, their penetrating, haunting fragrance distilled on the dewy air in every soft puff of wind. Along the fence rose bushes grew, but it was as yet too early in the season for roses. Beyond was the orchard proper, three long rows of trees with green avenues between, each tree standing in a wonderful blow of pink and white. The charm of the place took sudden possession of Eric as nothing had ever done before. He was not given to romantic fancies, but the orchard laid hold of him subtly and drew him to itself, and he was never to be quite his own man again. He went into it over one of the broken panels of fence, and so, unknowing, went forward to meet all that life held for him. He walked the length of the orchard's middle avenue between long, sinuous boughs picked out with delicate, rose-hearted bloom. When he reached its southern boundary, he flung himself down in a grassy corner of the fence where another lilac bush grew, with ferns and wild blue violets at its roots. From where he now was, he got a glimpse of a house about a quarter of a mile away, its gray gable peering out from a dark spruce wood. It seemed a dull, gloomy, remote place, and he did not know who lived there. He had a wide outlook to the west, over far hazy fields and misty blue intervales. The sun had just set, and the whole world of green meadows beyond swam in golden light. Across a long valley brimmed with shadow were uplands of sunset, and great sky lakes of saffron and rose where a soul might lose itself in color. The air was very fragrant with the baptism of the dew, and the odors of a bed of wild mint upon which he had trampled. Robins were whistling, clear and sweet and sudden, in the woods all about him. "This is a veritable haunt of ancient peace," quoted Eric, looking around with delighted eyes. "I could fall asleep here, dream dreams and see visions. What a sky! Could anything be diviner than that fine crystal eastern blue and those frail white clouds that look like woven lace? What a dizzying, intoxicating fragrance lilacs have! I wonder if perfume could set a man drunk. Those apple trees now, why, what is that? Eric started up and listened. Across the mellow stillness, mingled with the croon of the wind in the trees and the flute-like calls of the robins, came a strain of delicious music, so beautiful and fantastic that Eric held his breath in astonishment and delight. Was he dreaming? No, it was real music, the music of a violin played by some hand inspired with the very spirit of harmony. He had never heard anything like it, and, somehow, he felt quite sure that nothing exactly like it ever had been heard before. He believed that that wonderful music was coming straight from the soul of the unseen violinist, and translating itself into those most airy and delicate and exquisite sounds for the first time, the very soul of music, with all sense and earthiness refined away. It was an elusive, haunting melody, strangely suited to the time and place. It had in it the sigh of the wind in the woods, the eerie whispering of the grasses at dewfall, the white thoughts of the June lilies, the rejoicing of the apple blossoms, all the soul of all the old laughter and song and tears and gladness and sobs the orchard had ever known in the lost years. And besides all this, there was in it a pitiful, plaintive cry as of some imprisoned thing calling for freedom and utterance. At first Eric listened as a man spellbound, mutely and motionlessly, lost in wonderment. Then a very natural curiosity overcame him. Who in Lindsay could play a violin like that? And who was playing so here, in this deserted old orchard, of all places in the world? He rose and walked up the long white avenue, going as slowly and silently as possible, for he did not wish to interrupt the player. When he reached the open space of the garden, he stopped short in new amazement and was again tempted into thinking he must certainly be dreaming. Under the big branching white lilac tree was an old sagging wooden bench, and on this bench a girl was sitting, playing on an old brown violin. Her eyes were on the faraway horizon, and she did not see Eric. For a few moments he stood there and looked at her. The pictures she made photographed itself on his vision to the finest detail, never to be blotted from his book of remembrance. To his latest day, Eric Marshall will be able to recall vividly that scene as he saw it then. The velvet darkness of the spruce woods, the overarching sky of soft brilliance, the swaying lilac blossoms, and amid it all the girl on the old bench with the violin under her chin. He had, in his 24 years of life, met hundreds of pretty women, scores of handsome women, a scant half dozen of really beautiful women. But he knew at once, beyond all possibility of question or doubt, that he had never seen or imagined anything so exquisite as this girl of the orchard. Her loveliness was so perfect that his breath almost went from him in his first delight of it. Her face was oval, marked in every cameo-like line and feature with that expression of absolute, flawless purity found in the angels and Madonnas of old paintings, a purity that held in it no faintest strain of earthliness. Her head was bare, and her thick, jet-black hair was parted above her forehead and hung in two heavy, lustrous braids over her shoulders. Her eyes were of such a blue as Eric had never seen in eyes before, the tint of the sea in the still, calm light that follows after a fine sunset. They were as luminous as the stars that came out over Lindsay Harbor in the afterglow, and were fringed about with very long, soot-black lashes, and arched over by most delicately penciled dark eyebrows. Her skin was as fine and purely tinted as the heart of a white rose. The collarless dress of pale blue print she wore revealed her smooth, slender throat. Her sleeves were rolled up above her elbows, and the hand which guided the bow of her violin was perhaps the most beautiful thing about her, perfect in shape and texture, firm and white, with rosy-nailed taper fingers. One long drooping plume of lilac blossom lightly touched her hair and cast a wavering shadow over the flower-like face beneath it. There was something very childlike about her, and yet at least 18 sweet years must have gone to the making of her. She seemed to be playing half unconsciously, as if her thoughts were far away in some fair dreamland of the skies. But presently she looked away from the bourne of sunset, and her lovely eyes fell on Eric, standing motionless before her in the shadow of the apple trees. The sudden change that swept over her was startling. She sprang to her feet, the music breaking in mid-strain and the bow slipping from her hand to the grass. Every hint of color fled from her face, and she trembled like one of the wind-stirred June lilies. "I beg your pardon," said Eric hastily. "I am sorry that I have alarmed you, but your music was so beautiful that I did not remember you were not aware of my presence here. Please forgive me." He stopped in dismay, for he suddenly realized that the expression on the girl's face was one of terror, not merely the startled alarm of a shy, childlike creature who had thought herself alone, but absolute terror. It was betrayed in her blanched and quivering lips, and in the widely distended blue eyes that stared back into his with the expression of some trapped wild thing. It hurt him that any woman should look at him in such a fashion, at him who had always held womanhood in such reverence. "Don't look so frightened," he said gently, thinking only of calming her fear, and speaking as he would to a child. "I will not hurt you. You are safe, quite safe." In his eagerness to reassure her, he took an unconscious step forward. Instantly she turned, and, without a sound, fled across the orchard, through a gap in the northern fence and along what seemed to be a lane bordering the fir wood, beyond and arched over with wild cherry trees, misty white in the gathering gloom. Before Eric could recover his wits, she had vanished from his sight among the firs. He stooped and picked up the violin bow, feeling slightly foolish and very much annoyed. "Well, this is a most mysterious thing," he said, somewhat impatiently. "Am I bewitched? Who was she? What was she? Can it be possible that she is a Lindsay girl? And why in the name of all that's provoking should she be so frightened at the mere sight of me? I have never thought I was a particularly hideous person, but certainly this adventure has not increased my vanity to any perceptible extent. Perhaps I have wandered into an enchanted orchard and been outwardly transformed into an ogre. Now that I have come to think of it, there is something quite uncanny about the place. Anything might happen here. It is no common orchard for the production of marketable apples, that is plain to be seen. No, it's a most unwholesome locality, and the sooner I make my escape from it, the better." He glanced about it with a whimsical smile. The light was fading rapidly, and the orchard was full of soft, creeping shadows and silences. It seemed to wink sleepy eyes of impish enjoyment at his perplexity. He laid the violin bow down on the old bench. "Well, there is no use in my following her, and I have no right to do so, even if it were of use. But I certainly wish she hadn't fled in such evident terror. Eyes like hers were never meant to express anything but tenderness and trust. Why was she so frightened? And who can she be?" All the way home, over fields and pastures that were beginning to be moonlight-silvered, he pondered the mystery. "Let me see," he reflected. "Mr. Williamson was describing the Lindsay girls for my benefit the other evening. If I remember rightly, he said that there were four handsome ones in the district. What were their names? Flory Woods, Melissa Foster, no, Melissa Palmer, Emma Scott, and Jenny May Ferguson. Can she be one of them? No, it is a flagrant waste of time and gray matter supposing it. That girl couldn't be a Flory or a Melissa or an Emma, while Jenny May is completely out of the question. Well, there is some bewitchment in the affair. Of that I'm convinced, so I'd better forget all about it." But Eric found that it was impossible to forget all about it. The more he tried to forget, the more keenly and insistently he remembered. The girl's exquisite face haunted him, and the mystery of her tantalized him. True, he knew that, in all likelihood, he might easily solve the problem by asking the Williamsons about her. But somehow, to his own surprise, he found that he shrank from doing this. He felt that it was impossible to ask Robert Williamson, and probably have the girl's name overflowed in a stream of petty gossip concerning her and all her antecedents and collaterals to the third and fourth generation. If he had to ask anyone, it should be Mrs. Williamson. But he meant to find out the secret for himself, if it were at all possible. He had planned to go to the harbor the next evening. One of the lobstermen had promised to take him out cod fishing. But instead, he wandered southwest over the fields again. He found the orchard easily. He had half expected not to find it. It was still the same fragrant, grassy, wind-haunted spot. But it had no occupant, and the violin bow was gone from the old bench. Perhaps she tiptoed back here for it by the light of the moon, thought Eric, pleasing his fancy by the vision of a lithe, girlish figure, stealing with a beating heart through mingled shadow and moonshine. I wonder if she will possibly come this evening, or if I have frightened her away forever. I'll hide me behind this spruce copse and wait. Eric waited until dark, but no music sounded through the orchard and no one came to it. The keenness of his disappointment surprised him. Nay, more, it vexed him. What nonsense to be so worked up because a little girl he had seen for 5 minutes failed to appear. Where was his common sense, his gumption, as old Robert Williamson would have said? Naturally, a man liked to look at a pretty face. But was that any reason why he should feel as if life were flat, stale, and unprofitable, simply because he could not look at it? He called himself a fool and went home in a petulant mood. Arriving there, he plunged fiercely into solving algebraical equations and working out geometry exercises, determined to put out of his head forthwith all vain imaginings of an enchanted orchard, white in the moonshine, with lilts of elfin music echoing down its long arcades. The next day was Sunday, and Eric went to church twice. The Williamson pew was one of the side ones at the top of the church, and its occupants practically faced the congregation. Eric looked at every girl and woman in the audience, but he saw nothing of the face which, setting willpower and common sense flatly at defiance, haunted his memory like a star. Thomas Gordon was there, sitting alone in his long, empty pew, near the top of the building. And Neil Gordon sang in the choir, which occupied the front pew of the gallery. He had a powerful and melodious, though untrained voice, which dominated the singing and took the color out of the weaker, more commonplace tones of the other singers. He was well dressed in a suit of dark blue serge, with a white collar and tie, but Eric idly thought it did not become him so well as the working clothes in which he had first seen him. He was too obviously dressed up, and he looked coarser and more out of harmony with his surroundings. For 2 days Eric refused to let himself think of the orchard. Monday evening he went cod fishing, and Tuesday evening he went up to play checkers with Alexander Tracy. Alexander won all the games so easily that he never had any respect for Eric Marshall again. "Played like a feller whose thoughts were wool-gathering," he complained to his wife. "He'll never make a checker player, never in this world." End of chapter 5.
Chapter 6 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Karen Savage. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 6. The Story of Kilmeny. Wednesday evening, Eric went to the orchard again, and again he was disappointed. He went home determined to solve the mystery by open inquiry. Fortune favored him, for he found Mrs. Williamson alone, sitting by the west window of her kitchen, and knitting at a long gray sock. She hummed softly to herself as she knitted, and Timothy slept blackly at her feet. She looked at Eric with quiet affection in her large, candid eyes. She had liked Mr. West, but Eric had found his way into the inner chamber of her heart, by reason that his eyes were so like those of the little son she had buried in the Lindsay churchyard many years before. "Mrs. Williamson," said Eric, with an affectation of carelessness, "I chanced on an old deserted orchard back behind the woods over there last week, a charming bit of wilderness. Do you know whose it is?" "I suppose it must be the old Connors orchard," answered Mrs. Williamson, after a moment's reflection. "I had forgotten all about it. It must be all of 30 years since Mr. and Mrs. Connors moved away. Their house and barns were burned down, and they sold the land to Thomas Gordon and went to live in town. They're both dead now. Mr. Connors used to be very proud of his orchard. There weren't many orchards in Lindsay then, though almost everybody has one now." "There was a young girl in it, playing on a violin," said Eric, annoyed to find that it cost him an effort to speak of her, and that the blood mounted to his face as he did so. She ran away in great alarm as soon as she saw me, although I do not think I did or said anything to frighten or vex her. I have no idea who she was. Do you know?" Mrs. Williamson did not make an immediate reply. She laid down her knitting and gazed out of the window as if pondering seriously some question in her own mind. Finally she said, with an intonation of keen interest in her voice, "I suppose it must have been Kilmeny Gordon, master." "Kilmeny Gordon? Do you mean the niece of Thomas Gordon of whom your husband spoke?" "Yes." "I can hardly believe that the girl I saw can be a member of Thomas Gordon's family." "Well, if it wasn't Kilmeny Gordon, I don't know who it could have been. There is no other house near that orchard, and I've heard she plays the violin. If it was Kilmeny, you've seen what very few people in Lindsay have ever seen, master. And those few have never seen her close by. I have never laid eyes on her myself. It's no wonder she ran away, poor girl. She isn't used to seeing strangers." "I'm rather glad if that was the sole reason of her flight," said Eric. "I admit I didn't like to see any girl so frightened of me as she appeared to be. She was as white as paper, and so terrified that she never uttered a word, but fled like a deer to cover." "Well, she couldn't have spoken a word in any case," said Mrs. Williamson quietly. "Kilmeny Gordon is dumb." Eric sat in dismayed silence for a moment. That beautiful creature afflicted in such a fashion! Why, it was horrible! Mingled with his dismay was a strange pang of personal regret and disappointment. "It couldn't have been Kilmeny Gordon, then," he protested at last, remembering. "The girl I saw played on the violin exquisitely. I never heard anything like it. It is impossible that a deaf-mute could play like that." "Oh, she isn't deaf, master," responded Mrs. Williamson, looking at Eric keenly through her spectacles. She picked up her knitting and fell to work again. "That is the strange part of it, if anything about her can be stranger than another. She can hear as well as anybody, and understands everything that is said to her. But she can't speak a word and never could, at least so they say. The truth is, nobody knows much about her. Janet and Thomas never speak of her, and Neil won't either. He has been well questioned, too, you can depend on that. But he won't ever say a word about Kilmeny, and he gets mad if folks persist." "Why isn't she to be spoken of?" queried Eric impatiently. "What is the mystery about her?" "It's a sad story, master. I suppose the Gordons look on her existence as a sort of disgrace. For my own part, I think it's terrible the way she's been brought up. But the Gordons are very strange people, Mr. Marshall. I kind of reproved father for saying so, you remember, but it is true. They have very strange ways." "And you've really seen Kilmeny? What does she look like? I've heard that she was handsome. Is it true?" "I thought her very beautiful," said Eric rather curtly. "But how has she been brought up, Mrs. Williamson? And why?" "Well, I might as well tell you the whole story, master. Kilmeny is the niece of Thomas and Janet Gordon. Her mother was Margaret Gordon, their younger sister. Old James Gordon came out from Scotland. Janet and Thomas were born in the old country, and were small children when they came here. They were never very sociable folks, but still, they used to visit out some then, and people used to go there. They were kind and honest people, even if they were a little peculiar. Mrs. Gordon died a few years after they came out, and 4 years later James Gordon went home to Scotland and brought a new wife back with him. She was a great deal younger than he was, and a very pretty woman, as my mother often told me. She was friendly and gay and liked social life. The Gordon place was a very different sort of place after she came there, and even Janet and Thomas got thawed out and softened down a good bit. They were real fond of their stepmother, I've heard. Then, 6 years after she was married, the second Mrs. Gordon died, too. She died when Margaret was born. They say James Gordon almost broke his heart over it. Janet brought Margaret up. She and Thomas just worshipped the child, and so did their father. I knew Margaret Gordon well once. We were just the same age, and we sat together at school. We were always good friends until she turned against all the world. She was a strange girl in some ways even then, but I always liked her, though a great many people didn't. She had some bitter enemies, but she had some devoted friends, too. That was her way. She made folks either hate or love her. Those who did love her would have gone through fire and water for her. When she grew up she was very pretty, tall and splendid like a queen, with great thick braids of black hair and red, red cheeks and lips. Everybody who saw her looked at her a second time. She was a little vain of her beauty, I think, master. And she was proud. Oh, she was very proud. She liked to be first in everything, and she couldn't bear not to show to good advantage. She was dreadful determined, too. You couldn't budge her an inch, master, when once she had made up her mind on any point. But she was warm-hearted and generous. She could sing like an angel, and she was very clever. She could learn anything with just one look at it, and she was terrible fond of reading. When I'm talking about her like this, it all comes back to me. just what she was like, and how she looked and spoke and acted, and little ways she had of moving her hands and head. I declare it almost seems as if she was right here in this room instead of being over there in the churchyard. I wish you'd light the lamp, master. I feel kind of nervous." Eric rose and lighted the lamp, rather wondering at Mrs. Williamson's unusual exhibition of nerves. She was generally so calm and composed. "Thank you, master, that's better. I won't be fancying now that Margaret Gordon's here listening to what I'm saying. I had the feeling so strong a moment ago. I suppose you think I'm a long while getting to Kilmeny, but I'm coming to that. I didn't mean to talk so much about Margaret, but somehow my thoughts got taken up with her. Well, Margaret passed the board, and went to Queen's Academy and got a teacher's license. She passed pretty well up when she came out, but Janet told me she cried all night after the pass list came out, because there were some ahead of her. She went to teach school over at Radnor. It was there she met a man named Ronald Fraser. Margaret had never had a beau before. She could have had any young man in Lindsay if she had wanted him, but she wouldn't look at one of them. They said it was because she thought nobody was good enough for her, but that wasn't the way of it at all, master. I knew, because Margaret and I used to talk of those matters, as girls do. She didn't believe in going with anybody unless it was somebody she thought everything of, and there was nobody in Lindsay she cared that much for. This Ronald Fraser was a stranger from Nova Scotia, and nobody knew much about him. He was a widower, although he was only a young man. He had set up storekeeping in Radnor and was doing well, and had taking ways women like. It was said that all the Radnor girls were in love with him, but I don't think his worst enemy could have said he flirted with them. He never took any notice of them, but the very first time he saw Margaret Gordon he fell in love with her, and she with him. They came over to church in Lindsay together the next Sunday, and everybody said it would be a match. Margaret looked lovely that day, so gentle and womanly. She had been used to hold her head pretty high, but that day she held it drooping a little, and her black eyes cast down. Ronald Fraser was very tall and fair, with blue eyes. They made as handsome a couple as ever I saw. But old James Gordon and Thomas and Janet didn't much approve of him. I saw that plain enough one time I was there, and he brought Margaret home from Radnor Friday night. I guess they wouldn't have liked anybody, though, who came after Margaret. They thought nobody was good enough for her. But Margaret coaxed them all round in time. She could do pretty much near anything with them. They were so fond and proud of her. Her father held out the longest, but finally he gave in and consented for her to marry Ronald Fraser. They had a big wedding, too. All the neighbors were asked. Margaret always liked to make a display. I was her bridesmaid, master. I helped her dress, and nothing would please her. She wanted to look that nice for Ronald's sake. She was a handsome bride, dressed in white, with red roses in her hair and at her breast. She wouldn't wear white flowers. She said they looked too much like funeral flowers. She looked like a picture. I can see her this minute, as plain as plain, just as she was that night, blushing and turning pale by turns, and looking at Ronald with her eyes of love. If ever a girl loved a man with all her heart, Margaret Gordon did. It almost made me feel frightened. She gave him the worship it isn't right to give anybody but God, master, and I think that is always punished. They went to live at Radnor, and for a little while everything went well. Margaret had a nice house, and was gay and happy. She dressed beautiful and entertained a good deal. Then, well, Ronald Fraser's first wife turned up looking for him. She wasn't dead, after all. Oh, there was terrible scandal, master. The talk and gossip was something dreadful. Everyone you met had a different story, and it was hard to get at the truth. Some said Ronald Fraser had known all the time that his wife wasn't dead, and had deceived Margaret. But I don't think he did. He swore he didn't. They hadn't been very happy together, it seems. Her mother made trouble between them. Then she went to visit her mother in Montreal and died in the hospital there, so the word came to Ronald. Perhaps he believed it a little too readily, but that he did believe it, I never had a doubt. Her story was that it was another woman of the same name. When she found out Ronald thought her dead, she and her mother agreed to let him think so. But when she heard he had got married again, she thought she'd better let him know the truth. It all sounded like a queer story, and I suppose you couldn't blame people for not believing it too readily. But I've always felt it was true. Margaret didn't think so, though. She believed that Ronald Fraser had deceived her, knowing all the time that he couldn't make her his lawful wife. She turned against him and hated him just as much as she had loved him before. Ronald Fraser went away with his real wife, and in less than a year word came of his death. They said he just died of a broken heart. Nothing more nor less. Margaret came home to her father's house. From the day that she went over its threshold she never came out until she was carried out in her coffin 3 years ago. Not a soul outside of her own family ever saw her again. I went to see her, but Janet told me she wouldn't see me. It was foolish of Margaret to act so. She hadn't done anything real wrong, and everybody was sorry for her and would have helped her all they could. But I reckon pity cut her as deep as blame could have done, and deeper, because you see, master, she was so proud she couldn't bear it. They say her father was hard on her, too, and that was unjust if it was true. Janet and Thomas felt the disgrace, too. The people that had been in the habit of going to the Gordon place soon stopped going, for they could see they were not welcome. Old James Gordon died that winter. He never held his head up again after the scandal. He had been an elder in the church, but he handed in his resignation right away, and nobody could persuade him to withdraw it. Kilmeny was born in the spring, but nobody ever saw her except the minister who baptized her. She was never taken to church or sent to school. Of course, I suppose there wouldn't have been any use in her going to school when she couldn't speak, and it's likely Margaret taught her all she could be taught herself. But it was dreadful that she was never taken to church or let go among the children and young folks. And it was a real shame that nothing was ever done to find out why she couldn't talk, or if she could be cured. Margaret Gordon died 3 years ago, and everybody in Lindsay went to the funeral. But they didn't see her. The coffin lid was screwed down, and they didn't see Kilmeny either. I would have loved to see her for Margaret's sake, but I didn't want to see poor Margaret. I had never seen her since the night she was a bride, for I had left Lindsay on a visit just after that, and when I came home the scandal had just broken out. I remembered Margaret in all her pride and beauty, and I couldn't have borne to look at her dead face and see the awful changes I knew must be there. It was thought perhaps Janet and Thomas would take Kilmeny out after her mother was gone, but they never did, so I suppose they must have agreed with Margaret about the way she had been brought up. I've often felt sorry for the poor girl, and I don't think her people did right by her, even if she was mysteriously afflicted. She must have had a very sad, lonely life. That is the story, master, and I've been a long time telling it, as I dare say you think, but the past just seemed to be living again for me as I talked. If you don't want to be pestered with questions about Kilmeny Gordon, master, you'd better not let on you've seen her.
Eric was not likely to.
He had heard all he wanted to know and more. So this girl is at the core of a tragedy, he reflected as he went to his room, and she is dumb. The pity of it. Kilmeny. The name suits her. She is as lovely and innocent as the heroine of the old ballad. And oh, Kilmeny was fair to see. But the next line is certainly not so appropriate, for her eyes were anything but still and steadfast, after she had seen me, at all events. He tried to put her out of his thoughts, but he could not. The memory of her beautiful face drew him with a power he could not resist. The next evening he went again to the orchard. End of chapter 6.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.